Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, a call to action for Black Americans by New York Times columnist Charles Blow. He says racism is deeply embedded in the American system, and for the Black community to truly gain their civil rights, they need to think radically and act boldly. He lays out his plan in a new book titled The Devil You Know, A Black Power Manifesto. In it, he calls for a reversal to the Great Migration, which saw African Americans leave the South in huge numbers, fleeing racist laws and threats of violence. But now, he says, a return to Southern cities could provide the kind of Black political power the community has been unable to achieve in the North and West. Charles, it's good to have you with us. The violent attacks by Trump supporters at the Capitol earlier this month. Do you believe that white supremacy and racism is at the heart of those demonstrations?
I guess I would reframe it slightly the threat to white power and white supremacy is at the heart of it. It is the idea that white power would not have exclusive power in America is at the heart of it. The idea that the pie may be being divided more equitably is at the heart of it.
So it's fear of the loss of power that motivates many.
And primacy of all sorts. People sometimes think of that power as just being political power. That power is also economic. That power is also cultural power. It is the power of the American narrative that has always centered whiteness. It has always made white people, in particular white men, the heroes of this narrative. And that fed a sort of confidence to become. There's an amazing power of the imagination when it is fed. When you are told that you are destined to be great, when you are told that there are no barriers to your success, when you are told that if you just try, you will likely make it, that is the pact that America made with white people, particularly white men. And if you see that that pact is being undone or reneged upon, where other people are getting access to that, which you see as a diminution of your access to it, that's threatening.
Comparing today's red hats with the red shirts after the Civil War, talk about that.
Well, there have been many iterations of white terrorists in America, red shirts being one of them, ever since Black people were emancipated from enslavement and then granted by the 15th Amendment the right to vote. At least the men were at that point, Black men were. It was a real existential threat because in many of the Southern states, Black people outnumbered white people. In several of them, there were three. There were three others where they were within 4 percentage points of being a majority of the population. And in that, the first elections after the emancipation and during Reconstruction, states like Mississippi, the Black electorate was much larger than the white electorate. And so the only option that white supremacists had was violence. They couldn't win at the ballot box because they were outnumbered. And so the red shirts were formed to threaten and intimidate and to terrorize Black people out of voting.
So then how did the Trump forces carry that forward?
That has been carried forward for the 150 or whatever years since the end of the Civil War. Trump is the latest incarnation of that. When you see him trying actively to disenfranchise Black voters, him bragging that Black voters stayed home last election, and that's part of the reason that he won. When you see that the Russians who helped him were targeting Black voters to get them not to vote, you see him reestablish that idea this time around before the election, and then saying that, you know, he was going to have people and maybe sheriffs show up to watch the polls, which is all voter intimidation. And then after they had voted, to say, I am now going to attack these largely Black metropolitan areas as illegitimate in some way, fraudulent in some way. I want to disenfranchise those voters. I want to erase those voters so that I can win. How is that not the same thing?
Charles, I'm fascinated with the title of your book, The Devil You Know. What do you mean by that?
There's a line in the book where I say Black people left the South looking for a place where racism and oppression felt lightest in America, moving north, moving west, only to come to the realization that they had traded the devil they knew for the devil they didn't, that racism was everywhere, and that that becomes the American problem for Black people, that there is no space in the country where racism does not exist. It just has a different manifestation, a different coloring, a subtlety of it and a way of being, but that it is a universal trait in this country.
What did they leave in the South and then find in the North and West?
I will back up. It's important to remember that for nearly 50 years after the Emancipation Proclamation into the Civil War, Black people stayed in the South. They weren't anxious to move. Even with the red shirts, even with the rise of the Klan, even with the terror, they still stayed. What spurred people to move was that that terror kept building. There was no subsiding of it. But more importantly, I believe, was the economic push, meaning the collapse of the cotton industry with the invasion of boll weevil that kind of collapsed the cotton industry. And then the cotton industry faced problem after problem in the years after that and around that. So the economy that the Black people had, at least they could say, well, I have work here. I have generations of my family here. I may even own a little piece of land here. That connection began to fray. And at the very same time, Northern industry was blossoming, needed more workers. This was during the first wave of Great Migrations during the First World War. Many young men had gone off to fight. They needed bodies. And so they began to recruit in the South at the very same time that this industry that Black people in the South had depended on was collapsing. And there was a terror factor. And you could go to a place like Chicago or New York or Philadelphia, and the hand of oppression felt lighter.
It felt lighter, but was it really lighter? How were they treated once they got to places like Chicago?
Now, there are some ways that they were treated better, meaning in parts of the South, the labor practices were so skewed that it was basically slave labor. You could get a fairer wage in some of these destination cities that Black people fled to. There were also more opportunities for civic engagement, which were being denied in state after state across the South. So there were upsides. But the very same thing, way that white supremacy had operated in the South, as soon as they arrived in the North, it began to operate the same way there. Massive housing discrimination, intense pressure by police and authorities, and harassment on them. You know, it wasn't a utopia, and the many of the riots of what they called Red Summer, where white people attacked Black people in scores of cities across America, were because they had shown up in these white spaces and white people there felt pressure and didn't want them. They felt job pressure, they felt housing pressure, and they revolted.
What years would those have been?
1919. Is primarily, I think, the year, but some people stretch it over several years to include about 3 years, because there's really 3 years of violence.
So during those years, Blacks were employed. They did find better wages, but they were still regarded as not only second or third or fourth class, but regarded as the enemy by white people.
Very often that was exactly the case.
Did many of them or any number of Blacks who had fled to parts in the North think that perhaps returning to the South would make more sense, despite what they knew the conditions would be?
I don't think that was the thought. Racism was ubiquitous in America. It was just, what level were you willing to tolerate and what were you getting in return for it? And so for a large part of the first migration in particular, racism's everywhere, but you get a few more advantages, I think, for being in the North.
A few more advantages, wow. So you write that this country has had any number of racial reckonings, including most recently the massive Black Lives Matter protests last summer, but very little has changed. Why is that?
There are a number of reasons. One of them is that America doesn't really want that change, and that to a large degree, particularly in the federal level, but also in the state governorships and state houses, what we're constantly asked to do is to ask white people if they will recognize our humanity, particularly white men. If you wanted gun control, you'd have it if the white men in the Senate said they wanted it. If you wanted police reform, you'd have it if the white men in the Senate said they wanted it. Those men represent America, the way we have structured power in America. It's not necessarily that they represent the majority of the population, but that's not how we structured power in America. We didn't structure it because of what the majority said they wanted. The compromise was to make part of the legislative branch representative population and the other representative of land. There are more people living in Brooklyn than in Alaska, but Brooklyn doesn't have two senators. And so that means that the Senate doesn't have to necessarily respond to what most of America wants. And that's not even to say that most of America actually wants equity and inclusion and an egalitarian racial society, because it has yet to demonstrate that that's what it wants.
So now tell me what the most recent election in Georgia, with the election of a Black senator coming from one of the most racially divided states in the country, what does that signify to you?
It is the first time in American history that a Black senator has been popularly elected and the majority of the coalition that elected him was Black. We've had 10 other Black senators in American history, some of them not popularly elected, appointed by legislatures in the very beginning, the others after that popularly elected, but always by a majority of that coalition being white people. And in theory, that's not a problem. But the way power works in America is that you're most beholden to the people who bring you to power. Even those Black senators, although they may have been racially aware and proud of their heritage, they knew that to get reelected, they had to make sure that they did not offend the majority of the people who brought them to power. And anything that they might have done on the racial front that people might have thought too much, too far, too radical, whatever, they could not do. Warnock is not bound by that. The majority of people who sent him to the Senate are Black people. That's the first ever.
What kind of difference could that make? He's just one senator. How much difference could that really make in a Senate filled with primarily white men?
I don't think the difference is necessarily on individual pieces of legislation. The difference is in the signal that it sends. The reason that Warnock is able to be elected is in part because of the massive voter enfranchisement efforts by people like Stacey Abrams in this state. But the other reason is reverse migration of Black people out of the North and West to Georgia.
When did that begin?
It has been going on for decades. The metro region is now the number one destination for Black reverse migrants in America. The last time Georgia went blue was 1992. Black people were 25% of the population. They are now 33% of the population of Georgia. The Black population since 1990 has doubled in Georgia. That is what reverse migration can do. It can change the very politics of the South. That can send a whole delegation of Warnocks to the Senate. And that's where the change happens.
You're saying that reverse migration to Georgia could affect broad segments of the South, not just Georgia?
I think it is proof in concept that people moving back to the South can assume power, Black people can assume power and change the power dynamics of the South.
And how is that going to affect white attitudes toward those Blacks who come back to places like Georgia?
That is yet to be determined. Some people assume, and I think rightly so, that the voter suppression efforts already underway all across the country, including in the South, will be amped up. Some people assume, and I think rightly so, that gerrymandering will continue and maybe become more severe as much as they can get away with it without the courts stepping in. I think that's probably fair. But the problem is Senate seats are state seats. You can't gerrymander that away, right? Governorships are statewide seats. You can't gerrymander that away. Electoral college votes are statewide votes. You can't gerrymander that away. So even your efforts have a limit if you attempt to suppress.
Are there a growing number of Black members of both the House and Senate in Georgia?
I don't know the answer to that question.
It would be good to know that, because the devil you know is what they've gone back to.
Yes. But the inverse of that is to say, well, the Blackest city in America is New York. Is the delegation in New York, in New York State House, does that representative of that? New York State has never had a Black senator, even though New York City has 2 million Black people in it. They have three Black state representatives all in the city of New York. There is only one majority Black city in all of New York State. That's Yonkers. If you go to California with all those Black people who live there, there's not a single majority Black city in the entire state. And is that state house full of Black people? Does that delegation, did they send to Washington full of Black people? You have to decide where you want your power to be. If you leave 2 million people in New York City and they've had one Black mayor 30 years ago and they can't elect a senator, and New York is going to be blue regardless of whether or not they vote in New York or not. Black people have to decide if they want power. If we're going to be nibbling around the edges and afraid of what the backlash may be, then you would have never moved north. Because what happened in Chicago, the riot in Chicago, when Black people moved to Chicago, was deadly. And they still moved. The mistake would be to allow fear to be the motivator rather than possibility.
I'm fascinated to learn that the bulk of Georgia's population growth from 2010 to 2018, the white population increased nearly 4% and the Black population grew 17%. That's got to give whites in that state at least some second thoughts as to what's going on there.
But what second thoughts?
They are fearing, perhaps, that Georgia could become a Black majority state.
And I say to white America, why are you afraid of that? Every state in America other than Hawaii for 90 years has been majority white, and no one has blinked an eye and said that's a problem in a country that is becoming majority-minority. As we talk today, there are seven states in America that are 90-plus percent white, right? 14% of the Senate is representing these states that are 90-plus percent white. Those people are not beholden to me. I am not their constituency. I would hope that they would be egalitarian and race blind when they make choices about legislation they propose or support. But there is no guarantee of that because I am not their constituency. And no one blinks an eye and says that is a problem. But the moment you say you might tip 51% Black, there's a fear? Should I not be afraid to travel into a state that's 90% white? Then why would you be afraid to be in one that's 51% Black? And the problem is there are 42 million Black people in America. If you put all seven of those 90-plus percent white states together, there are four times as many Black people in America as the total population of those seven states. We don't have a governor. We have one senator now with Warnock. I am not interested in white people's fear because it is unfounded other than in racism if you are afraid to be governed by Black people when Black people have been governed by white people since they landed on this piece of earth.
Do you think there is the possibility in the not too distant future that because of the growth of the Black population in this country, that time of Black governance over white is coming sooner rather than later?
Well, I'd like to make two points on this. Number one, if Black people were not essentially chased out of the South, they would have been governing anyway. Those states were majority Black. The only reason that you don't have majority Black states right now is because of white terror. Put a peg in that because I don't want us to ever forget that that is the reason it doesn't exist today. Number two is the Black population as a percentage of the overall population is not expected to grow. It will remain stagnant by about 2055, the Hispanic population will be twice the Black population in America. The Asian population will be bigger than the Black population in America. Several of the Southwestern states won't just be majority minority, they'll be majority Hispanic. There will be a region of the country that they can control if they want to. They can send Hispanic senators to the Senate if they want to, and I believe that they should. You know, Oregon, Washington, down into the Rockies will likely remain majority white. The Midwest and East Coast, many of those states will be some fluctuation of majority-minority, but a plurality of white people. Not a single state is projected to be majority Black. Black people have to ask themselves, do you want some state power? There's a reason that it is called the United States of America, because states have the power. The Constitution makes very clear that any power not specifically given to the federal government is reserved for the states. That's where it is. And if I look out and see a future where you don't have real access to that power, I see a path where you are robbed of access to that power. You have to make a choice about whether or not you want that power.
More of my conversation with Charles Blow when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here is the rest of my conversation with Charles Blow, columnist for the New York Times and author of a new book, The Devil You Know, A Black Power Manifesto. Tell me how you see Joe Biden's attitude toward the population at large and the Black population in particular.
I think Joe Biden ran as a return to normalcy candidate, and he will likely be a return to normalcy president. He has made some interesting choices, some of them historic choices, about trying to include more people in appointed positions. The problem with all that is administrations come and go. We are in kind of a pendulum politics right now. We swing far to the left, and the response to that is a backlash that swings you far to the right. And it seems like we're trying to go as farther than the last time. Appointed positions are great. Firsts are great, even if they, you know, strike the consciousness as problematic that you would have first of anything in 2021. But that is not where the real power lies that is going to affect the lives of Black people for the long term, or any people for the long term, right? That is in policy. Can you advance the policies that are important to you? If I look at the things that people were in the streets this summer marching about, and the same things they were in the streets in the 60s marching about, those things are largely state issues. Mass incarceration is largely a state issue. Most of the prisoners are not federal prisoners. The justice system largely a state issue. The state makes the criminal code. The state attorney generals are elected. Many local and state judges are elected. That's a state issue. Educational policy and financing, largely a state issue. Health policy, largely a state issue. You really want to change those dynamics? You have to do that on a state level. I think it's lovely when you have a Black person in a cabinet position. And maybe in some ways that will help, but it will help in ways that can be reversed 4 years from now or 8 years from now. I don't want reversal. You know, Diane, I think about this all the time. I have 3 adult children in this world. I do not want to pass away from this life with them fighting the same fight that I fought, that my mother fought, that my grandmother fought. The idea of that shocks me. It shocks my system that they waited, that they thought it was gonna get better. And maybe better, it did get, but it didn't, it wasn't resolved. And I don't even like the idea of the progress argument, because we're starting from a thing that should never have been done in the first place. There should never have been enslavement. There should not have been a racial hierarchy that put me at the bottom. We're all human beings with the same capacity, looking up at the same stars at night, dreaming. The idea that it would take 400 years to slowly inch our way out of it and not still yet to be out of it is infuriating to me. I am not satisfied to wait. I am not satisfied to give anybody a laurel because they say that today is not the 60s or it's not the 1860s. It should never have been that way. This should never have been done.
But it has been done. It is that way. So how do you ask the question earlier? Do Black people really want this power? How do they go about creating this power for themselves?
That's the central thesis of the book, which is that you return to the places where you would have been the majority in the first place. I'm not saying go somewhere foreign. Go to the same place you go to the family reunion every summer.
Why?
Because when you increase your political power in those states, and all of those issues that states could address even more effectively than federal governments, you change the reality on the ground for people who look like you. The idea is not to impose some sort of Black racial hierarchy. It is to remove a racial hierarchy that was imposed on you. I don't want some racial solidarity government. That doesn't appeal to me. I want people to be conscious and responsive that I have enough power that I can do something about this. You can't just treat me anyway and I have no recourse.
So are you saying to your Black brothers and sisters, go home?
Absolutely.
Leave the East Coast. Go south. Reestablish yourself in those communities and create the power that you were forced to relinquish and leave behind.
Absolutely.
So is your book primarily addressed to African Americans in this country?
Absolutely.
And do you wonder whether they are willing to leave behind the gains they may feel they have made and resist moving back to those southern states where the bias against them continues to exist? Where the discrimination continues to exist. Do you really think they'll do that?
Two things on that point. One is not everybody migrated during the Great Migration. Most people who were in the South, Black people stayed in the South.
Stayed.
So I'm not asking everybody to move. No, not everybody won't move, have never done that in any migration, whether Black or the Gold Rush or anything else. So I'm asking people who are motivated to do it, to act on it and to consider it. Number two is this. This idea, I mean, it kind of embedded in your question is that racism is, the South is where the racism is. No, it's everywhere. Stop and frisk didn't happen in Jackson, Mississippi. It didn't happen in Greensboro. It didn't happen in Birmingham. It happened in New York City. It happened in Chicago. It happened in Los Angeles. When you look, take a look at right now, the cities where the police department are on the consent decrees by the federal government, most of them are in these cities and states that where Black people migrated to. They're not in the South. I asked the people at the Project Implicit, this massive database that they have where they test the implicit bias of people. They have hundreds of thousands of these tests to cut their data by region and by race. And what they found, what there was virtually no difference in the implicit racial bias between white people in the South and those in the Midwest and those in the North. They just answer polling questions better. When Quinnipiac asked every year that they asked white people in New York City whether they agree with stop and frisk, every year a majority of them said yes. I need people to stop saying that the South is where the problem is, like the North, Northern whites, including white supposedly liberals, are not imposing discriminatory practices on Black bodies, because they are. In the book, I looked at Black incarceration per capita. The people who incarcerated the largest percentage of their Black people were not in the South. They were in these Northern liberal states. They were in places like Vermont. Malcolm X says, stop talking about the South. If you're south of the Canadian border, you're south. White people in the North have constantly for decades, generations try to excuse their racism by pointing to their white brothers in the South and saying, no, they're the worst, they're worse than us. And the very act of denying that their racism exists allowed militarized police to spring up, allowed hyper-segregation to spring up, allied concentrated poverty to spring up right in those cities. The problem with liberalism is that just because you want to save the planet and you like gay marriage doesn't mean you're a racial egalitarian. But people like to believe that liberalism means that you are interested in equality across the board. Sometimes people are not. And Black people have learned that the hard way.
If you do have a migration back to the South, what kinds of jobs will be available to those Blacks who are moving into a still majority white area?
So when Forbes did its list of places where the Black middle class was thriving, many of those cities are in the South. When you look at the places where Black would have the largest percentage of Black-owned business, almost all of those places are in the Southeast of the country. Conversely, when you look at places where it's worse for Black people to live, almost all of those are destination cities. And that's taking a bunch of measurements. That's access to housing and income and all sorts of things.
Destination cities being what?
Destination city, I use that term as shorthand. These are the cities to which Black people migrated during the Great Migration.
And what would those cities be?
The big ones are Chicago, Cleveland, Delaware, New York, Philadelphia.
Baltimore. And reverse migration, what would those destination cities be?
So I've given this a lot of thought. So my, I propose that people move very specific group of cities, I think it's nine of them, from Louisiana all the way up to Delaware. People don't always think of Delaware as a southern city, but the Census Bureau does. And Delaware is also, I think, the eighth blackest city in America, so blackest state in America. So always remember that it is, to the Census Bureau, a southern state, and we should consider it that way. I do not include Texas, nor do I include Florida as reverse migration targets. And a lot of the what they call the Upper South are not included. So, and then what I was trying to do is to identify specific cities that I thought would be best for reverse, because a lot of the people who migrated to large cities. And so they are used to a certain urbanity, and that will probably be more attractive to people returning. In addition to that, I thought about what is definitely coming, which is climate migration, which is going to push a lot of people out of certain regions of the country, including the South. So none of the cities are coastal cities. I took a look at the kind of floodplains just to make sure where the rivers were. I mean, all of that is a consideration. You don't want people to moving into places where they would be in any sort of danger. But there's a string of cities: Shreveport, Jackson, Atlanta, all the way up to Wilmington, where almost all of them have Black mayors, many of them young, dynamic, first Black or youngest mayor ever, just dynamic young people. Many of those cities are capital cities of those states. So I just try to provide a list of actual options in terms of both the states that I think make the most sense, but also cities that would make sense.
Charles, what about your own experience? Do you figure into this entire reverse migration picture?
Yes, I moved to Atlanta in last January, and I'm from the South. It was important for me to spell out that I had spent half my life in the South and half of it out of it. And it just gave me a more well-rounded picture, both of how Black culture was bifurcated in a way, that there's a Southern aesthetic to Blackness, and there's also a Northern Western aesthetic, not the same in the North and West, but the children of the Great Migration have a particularness to them that is not the same as in the South. But also, it was important for me to demonstrate that you weren't giving up, that you weren't running to make this choice. You know, a lot of my friends in New York, you know, thought it was crazy. You know, how do you, it's so hard to make it in New York. How do you come to New York and you make it and you become anointed by, you know, intelligentsia and white society and give it up?
And what have you found?
I said easily, because none of that was helping the whole. Like, there is something, you know, I don't want to be the exceptional Negro that gets invited to the cocktail parties. I don't want your exposure to me to coax you into believing that you have exposure to Blackness writ large, and that you care and that you're an egalitarian because of it. It's not true. You're not doing enough. And I am not doing enough. It is important for people in community to see me walk down the street or walk into a restaurant or you know, shop for paper towels at the store. That's important to me. And also, it was thrilling to be in a state that was a swing state and to watch it turn and to go and vote and see how narrowly they won. And you know that your vote mattered in a way that had never really mattered when I lived in New York, because it was going to be blue whether I showed up or not. I just showed up because that's my civic duty. That's huge to me.
So, personally speaking, how have you found your own ability to blend in with both a Black and white society there in Atlanta?
Well, in a pandemic, there's not very much society.
That's true. That's true. That's true.
But, you know, it's an interesting thing. You know, I knew this from growing up in a majority Black town. And, you know, you remember all this when it's you experience it again, now that I'm in a majority Black city, just how normal and unremarkable it is that your city officials would be Black, or that you walk into some business, many businesses, and everybody running it is Black. And it's just unremarkable. It's not a thing. And there's a beauty to that to me, because it shouldn't be a thing. It shouldn't be a thing. And, you know, our mayor here, Keisha Lance Bottoms, just competent leadership, because these are human beings. Race is something that we created. Give human beings a shot, a chance, opportunity. They will respond the way human beings respond. Some people will be scoundrels. Other people will be excellent, because that's how human beings behave. And, you know, and I just love seeing that and reminding myself that, you know, to make it in this city just looks like human beings making it. And there was something about New York that was terribly segregated. You know, you look at the map of New York City and it's just terrible segregation, and is reflected in the schools. New York State is the most segregated schools system in America, largely because of the segregation in New York City. But people there convince themselves that they are living this incredibly diverse existence, when in fact that's not the case.
I have one final question for you, and that is, to whom would you target this idea and ideal most specifically?
Migrations have always been primarily about the young and unencumbered. people who have established, who've established themselves, who own property, very unlikely to move or less likely to move. Young people just starting a life, not a family or at all, or if they have a family, a small one, not rooted, not weighed down with a mortgage, everything's possible. I'm saying to them, consider this possibility.
Charles, I want to thank you so much for being with us. It's a fascinating conversation. I truly enjoyed speaking with you.
Thank you so much.
That was Charles Blow, New York Times columnist and the author of the new book titled The Devil You Know, A Black Power Manifesto. And that's all for today. Thanks to those who've written in to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman, Sandra Baker, and Allison Brody. Our engineer is Mike Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Please stay well, stay safe, wear those masks. I'm Diane Rehm.